You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Have a little love on a little honeymoon. You got a little dish and you got a little spoon. A little bitty house and a little bitty yard. A little bitty dog and a little bitty car. But it's all right to be a little bitty. A little hometown or a big old city. Might as well share, might as well smile. Life goes on for a little bitty while.
Alan Jackson singing about little things. Here's an email. Mac, do you think it would be pretty cool if instead of doing the news one night, they put something like that on? Actual learning taking place. Holy smokes. Who would believe that would ever happen? Alright. I mentioned this earlier, but in case you've just joined us since then, the commanding officer of the former commanding officer of the 4th Marine Regiment is an all-Marine radio guy, Colonel Kevin Norton. He's now the Chief of Staff of the 3rd Marine Division. So I'm hoping to get out there and do post-traumatic wing for them and actually get to meet Colonel Norton. Anyway, he sent me a couple of interviews that he did with veterans of the 3rd Marine Division, and I believe they both fought in the 4th Marine Regiment. The interview you're going to hear now is about 22 minutes. Lieutenant Colonel Art Antczak, A-N-T-C-Z-A-K. Now, you can bet that that was probably shortened from something when they came over, but you're going to hear Colonel Norton interview him here. And the first about minute is kind of a slow ceremonial version of the Marines hymn. And with some steel images of Marines going up cargo nets, going ashore and things like that. So I always find it fascinating. First-person accounts. It's why I love them. It's why you just heard the Secretary of Defense, not in a soundbite, but in a complete sentence. And that's where the headline came from. In the early bird, number one story is Mattis sets 30-day deadline for Yemen ceasefire. That came out of that interview. So, but again, it's not the headline. I mean, is lame, and the story is lame compared to, you know, the entire interview, which is phenomenal. So, anywho, here you have it, Lieutenant Colonel Art Antczak, in his own words, with Colonel Kevin Norton. At the time, he was commanding officer of the 4th Marine Regiment on Okinawa, Japan.
Well, everybody in the country was stunned, with the exception of people in the military. I was in the Marine Corps 7 months prior to Pearl Harbor, and we knew eventually we would get into the war situation because Germany has already invaded Poland with Europe and they're fighting the British, and so that was it. All Marines were infantry at that time until you went to your first assignment. Some Marines went directly to the air group, or they went to supply school, but most of us were infantry. In those days, we took our 1903 rifles and a backpack. We went on a train, went directly to the Washington Navy Yard, and I was assigned there for guard duty. President Roosevelt had a yacht at the Washington Navy Yard, and usually on weekends, he would go aboard that yacht. And the Marines, we always stood at the gangway there and presented arms, and there was always a six-man Marine detachment aboard that yacht. And he usually cruised down to the river to all the way down to Norfolk sometimes and came back out for the weekend. So I saw President Roosevelt many, many times on those occasions. Well, at the Macon Island, which was August 1942, Major Roosevelt was ordered back to Washington, D.C., and the Commandant of the Marine Corps established two more Raider Battalions, the 3rd and 4th Raider Battalions. And Lieutenant Colonel Roosevelt then went up down the East Coast interviewing people for the 4th Raider Battalion. That was his battalion. I was personally interviewed by Colonel Roosevelt in the Washington Navy Yard. There was about 40 of us that were interviewed. And I was one of the ones that was selected for the 4th Raider Battalion. Well, you had to be an excellent swimmer to begin with. He wanted you to be an excellent swimmer, and he wanted you to be at least a sharpshooter rifle and pistol. And then he asked you a question, why do you want to be a Raider? Well, I had a brother, Bruno Anzac, who lived his entire life in Poland. And he fought in the Polish Army fought the Germans in 1939. He was a prisoner of war, but he was a farmer. And he went back to the farm and worked for the Nazi regime, So he survived. And we did not know what happened to him for about 8 years till after the war. And that was one of the reasons I wanted to get into the war and help win the war against the Nazis. So that was a good point on my part, because he says, this young Polish boy has a grudge against the Axis powers, and so I made the 4th Raider Battalion. After we were selected for the 4th Battalion, we went to Camp Pendleton. We trained at Camp Pendleton. We were there October, November, December, and February. We went overseas on the President Polk, and we did all our training in Camp Pendleton. Tent Camp Tree, adjacent to San Clemente. We did a lot of rubber boat training and a lot of force marches and a lot of night fighting. We had martial arts, knife fighting, and a lot of rubber boat training. Because on Macon Island, the Raiders there had a problem with the rubber boats getting back to the submarines, so we did a lot of rubber boat training. Well, we were eager to get into combat after all that hard training at Camp Pendleton and Guadalcanal and doing a little mop-up patrols there. We were very, very eager to go. So when we were ordered to Sagi Point to help Captain Kennedy, they knew the Japanese were ready to attack. We were eager to get in there and meet and destroy the enemy. In fact, many of us were afraid the war was going to end before we got there. That's how motivated we were. We were very motivated. Squads in those days, Raider days, was a 10-man squad, three fire teams. So you had the squad leader, then you had the first fire team with the Thompson submachine gun, which I had, the two M1s. Second fire team with three M1s, and the third fire team with two M1s and a BAR. That was the composition of a Marine Raider Squad, Rifle Squad. Well, we first went to New Hebrides, and I happened to be in the advanced detail to go to the canal. And while we were in the New Hebrides, and before we went to New Hebrides, we operated the old World War I destroyers called APDs, Assault Personnel Destroyers. The World War I destroyers had four stacks. They removed the two rear stacks and made room for about 150 personnel. And they used those APDs for moving people like the Raiders, reconnaissance teams, and also supplies, for supplies, supply outposts and areas in the islands in the Pacific. But we did a lot of training of APDs for rubber boats, daytime, nighttime, constantly. And we went to many islands looking for a Japanese outpost, listening post, coast watcher post. And there's a lot of islands around the New Hebrides and islands around the Guadalcanal. We were on New Georgia 7 days. The 4th Raider Battalion, O&P Company, was on New Georgia 7 days before the 1st Battalion, Raider Battalion, or the Army units, invaded New Georgia. And that was because a Captain Kennedy, a British coast watcher in Sagi Point in New Georgia, had a native of 60 natives with armed with the Enfield rifles, 1903 rifles, and a couple of Lewis machine guns. They were told that the Japanese knew they were there and they were ready to attack Sagi Point. That's when O&P Company and Colonel Carmen went to Sagi, overnight deal. We were there for about 2 days, set up defense perimeters, and then the Army came in and set up the defense. From there, we went on our way through the jungles to attack Pearl Harbor. The terrain in New Georgia is very heavy foliage.
All right, you're listening to a interview that Colonel Kevin Norton did, CO of 4th Marine Regiment. Just gave it up here a couple months ago, now Chief of Staff of the 3rd Marine Division, did with a retired Marine, Lieutenant Colonel by the name of Art Antzak, who fought in World War II as part of the Marine Raiders and as part of the 3rd Marine Division. And I love this kind of stuff. It's awesome.
Mangrove swamps from the sending down all the way down to the beach. Very, very few open beaches. New Georgia, to me, it was a big swamp, very similar to Bougainville. I was not on Bougainville, but New Georgia was mangrove swamps all the way down to the shoreline. The heaviest weapon we have, of course, is the light machine guns and the 60 mortar guns. But on New Georgia, the overhead foliage was so hard, you couldn't use them. When the Japanese in defense positions, of course, cleared the overhead, they used their mortar type and heavy weapons also. So we were at a disadvantage in places like New Georgia when we were in an attack mode. We had to rely strictly on light weapons and machine guns and hand grenades. That was about it. After the New Georgia campaign in February 1944, the Raiders were disestablished, and we had the honor of being the 4th Marine Regiment. That was a great honor for us. The four Raider battalions were disestablished. I was assigned to the Weapons Company and 4th Marine Regiment under Commander Captain Luckle, Ray Luckle, who I met years later as Lieutenant Colonel, and had malaria and dengue fever. I ended up in the hospital, and that's what when the regiment was being formed with the combat companies and weapons companies, what have you. They decided to put me in the military police. Each regiment had a military police company in those days. And I was assigned to the military police company, which is okay. I was a little beat up at that time, and I was a little mad because I was used to good, you know, Raider training with the Raiders and the combat organization. Although the military police had a job to do, and we did it. Battle of Guam, we landed at Agat Beach, which was heavily fortified, concrete bunkers, what have you. The Japanese had like 37 millimeter cannons on each side of the Agat Beach. And I was in about the third wave, and I remember there's about four or five LVTs, land vehicle tractors, burning and up on the beach that were knocked out. But we were moving in on Agat. It was heavily fortified at Agat. Our job was to keep the process of keeping the lanes open and moving and picking up stragglers as the battalions were going forward in the combat situation. So we had a job to do. You know, we set up what they call them our detention centers, I guess. So primarily our job was to keep the traffic moving in stragglers type situations. And Okinawa was a little more because there was more Japanese there, a lot of Korean laborers that were attached to the Japanese units in those days, you know. The Guam operation, Okinawa, you know, there was a lot of Korean laborers that they utilized, not Japanese. We went up to Mount Alifan. From there we went to Rote Peninsula, where the old Marine barracks were at. That's where I got the severe damage to my right eardrum. We were following a Sherman tank and mop-up operations. And the Japanese took these torpedoes, naval torpedoes, put them in the ground, buried them in the ground. Anything 250 pounds or heavier, or 300 pounds or heavier, they blew up. In this case, the Sherman tank was about 100 yards in front of us. And we were the picking up stragglers in those days. But this tank hit this torpedo, and of course it was blown out of action, and the people in the tank were killed. But the other busted eardrum is an example of that.
I knew a man, a Marine. He was a captain at the time. Started out as a Raider. They moved him into tanks. He was in a tank that hit an aerial torpedo, and he was standing up in, obviously, in a turret, and he was blown out of it. Everybody else in the tank was killed. And they used to bury aerial bombs, aerial torpedoes in the ground, and put an anti-tank mine on top of it and destroy tanks like that. And Art just told a story about how he lost his hearing being near one of those explosions. Wow.
Situation over Rote Peninsula. And, of course, there was more open to terrain fighting on Guam because it was not like New Georgia or Bougainville with heavy vegetation. So you can maneuver much better with tanks. In fact, the first time we saw Japanese tanks was in my experience was on Guam, going up to Mount Elephant. There was about three or four light Japanese tanks that were knocked out by our tanks. So that was the first time we saw Japanese tanks. The invasion of Guam was the Pacific Normandy, biggest amphibious operation in the Pacific area. And we trained on Guadalcanal, and then we went aboard ship, and we went to Ulysses. And we were aboard ship for about 6 weeks. We thought we might be going to Iwo Jima at that time, but there's no place to land on Iwo Jima because there's three divisions there already, and it was heavily contested. So actually, we ended up on Okinawa, and like I say, the training there was a larger magnitude, more tank training, tank support, heavy artillery support, that kind of stuff. So the training there was much different from the early days, my Marine Raider days. We upgraded our training constantly, you know, as each campaign was involved, then the units became larger, and the operations were more maneuverable, use of artillery and combat arms type situation, air strikes and that kind of stuff. 6th Division spent about 16 days in the motor boot peninsula to clean that out. Then we went south with the 1st Division and the 3 Army Divisions. But the first day of landing on Okinawa, of course, was rather mild. They let us come ashore. And that very first night at where Kadena Air Base is now, where we landed, the kamikazes came in the very first day. We had a lot of kamikaze action throughout the Okinawan campaign. Primarily during the last phase of it, there was the last stand, of course, and the Navy took a real beating on Okinawa from kamikaze. I watched the kamikazes, and the first day hit one of our destroyers, and it just folded in half and went down the first night. So again, life at the military police company was a little lighter as opposed to being in the frontline unit. But we had our share of bad times also, because we supported the battalions right up front all the way through the campaign. And again, when after the Marine 6th Division went up north after 16 days, it took over the Motor Vehicle Peninsula, which included the town of Nago, one of my favorite places. We went south with the 1st Division and the 3 Army.
All right. We have to switch to part two. Stand by. Again, I could watch. I do. I watch this stuff when I can find it all day. And much love to Colonel Norton for doing this. This kind of stuff is phenomenal. His experience in World War II, starting out as a raider, getting banged up, going to a military police company, their function on the beach as the battalions moved inland, and then him having a ringside seat for the battle on Okinawa. You know, it's one of the most horrible parts of that battle were the kamikazes, and that, as he said, that was their last gasp. Those kamikazes against that task force, and you know, the brave sailors that paid the price to deliver the Marines there, to protect them, and then ultimately who lost their lives via just wave after wave of kamikaze attacks. Again, this is Lieutenant Colonel Art Anzac, retired, so United States Marine Corps, talking about World War II here just recently, within the last year.
Divisions, where the main battle took place. So the 6th Marine Division actually was responsible for about 55% of taking Okinawa. Really. So we had our times. Because we were on the right flank, and the 3 Army Division on the left flank. And they were pretty well stalled, because the southern part of the Okinawa had open areas, and you had ridge lines. You had about a mile of open terrain, ridge line, a mile of open terrain and ridge line, which finally led to the main fortification of Shuri Castle, Sugarloaf Hill, and those areas where the casualties were very, very high. Fighting at Sugarloaf Hill, we supported the 22nd Marines primarily. They took Sugarloaf Hill about six times, and we were taken by the Japanese six times. 22nd Marines got heavy casualty. Finally, we withdrew them, and the 4th Marines went in and finally took Sugarloaf Hill. And again, we were in a sport mode with the military police company, but we were very, very close to each of those battalions, you know. Regiment, the 4th Marines, 22nd Marines. But the 22nd Marines had a lot of casualties on the Sugarloaf Hill, a lot of casualties. And the Army was on the left flank. They finally overpowered Shuri Castle, the main defensive positions for the Japanese, which was Shuri Castle. And the 4th Marines, 22nd and 29th Marines were heavily involved in that. Of course, the 15th Marines are artillery units with us. So I remember Sugarloaf Hill very vividly. We lost a lot of tanks there. We were there for about 3 weeks. And the heavy rains at that time, mud and muck, and really bad situation. Every time the forward elements took the hill, Japanese retook it. Up, back and forth, back and forth. So it was a sort of a bad situation there for a while. But eventually the Marines prevailed, you know. After Okinawa, we went back to Guam.
That fight is something that I should devote some time to in a battle study because the attacks and counterattacks on Sugarloaf Hill, yeah, crazy. I mean, that Okinawa is, you know, and again, it's not, you can imagine Okinawa veterans a little bit bitter. Iwo Jima sucks the air out of the room. When you talk about 1945 in the Pacific, and you watch or you read about Okinawa, and you're like, holy shit, man, holy shit. Again, we continue.
And refitted, and when I was back on Guam, the second day we got back on Guam, I re-enlisted. My enlist was up for 4 years, and about 3 weeks later, they dropped the atomic bomb on Hiroshima. So I had enough points for three guys to go back home. He said, Sergeant Anzac, I have enough points. He said, you just re-enlisted. You're going to Japan. A lot of the guys that I knew went back home. I ended up, which is okay. I said, if we go to Japan, I'm not going to make it this one. It's going to be all over. So thank God they dropped that atomic bomb, and otherwise, I was very, very fortunate. And my story to most young men is that even though go to get as much schooling as you can, in my case, I had World War II career in Vietnam to help me. And hard work and dedication to duty, you know, I survived. But it was very, very, very difficult. It was a stupid way to do it. I'm very, very proud of my service in the Marine Corps. And the history and traditions of the Marine Corps, we get a lot of that from the British Marines to begin with. When Marines graduate from boot camp, they finally get that Marine Corps. And they're no longer a recruit, they're a Marine. These the tears coming out most of the time, you can see that. And the difference there is tradition and hard work, and dedication to duty, and dedication to your country and to your corps. That's the main thing. Being a former drill instructor and being a high school dropout, I can tell you that it's very, very difficult not to love the Marine Corps and the people in it, the dedication to our core and our values. And it's a wonderful feeling. So, any young man who wants to go to the Marines, stay tough, work hard, be dedicated, do your job the best of your ability, you'll be fine. It's going to be tough.
How about that? That is awesome. From the Raiders. Enlisted 7 months before World War II. Joined the Raiders. Trained at Pendleton as part of, what do you say, the 4th Ranger Raider Battalion. And then the Raiders have disbanded. He becomes part of the 4th Marine Division. And he's sick. He gets assigned to an MP company, and he finishes the war in that company. My thanks again to the commanding officer, the former commanding officer of the 4th Marine Regiment, Colonel Kevin Norton, for doing that. You'll hear another one tomorrow. You'll hear another interview with a veteran of the 4th Marine Regiment, 3rd Marine Division. You'll hear that interview tomorrow. So catching up on some stuff. Some awesome stuff. So, how cool. Honestly, man, I love this kind of stuff. It's a cool organization. Our history, and that flag raising statue is symbolic of not just what happened in World War II, but, of our history that we embrace so much as Marines. That's the wrong song. That's the right song. The morning started off a little bit rough. My apologies. My thanks, though, to Ohio Man for saving the day. I'd still been talking to myself if he hadn't sent an email. So my thanks to him. I forgot to flip the switch. See, what happens is there's a couple of different feeds for All Marine Radio. And there's a loop feed. And so before I go on the air in the morning, I have to shut the loop feed off and then open the channel that streams the live feed. Yeah, didn't do that. I was so excited about... Honestly, I was really fired up to hear the Secretary of Defense. And I was really fired up for that. And then as fired up as I was for that, I was equally as fired up, maybe more fired up for these pieces of audio history. I was talking to Chris Woodbridge, the editor of the Gazette, and he says there's a treasure trove in the Marine Corps archives that the Marine Corps has yet to digitize, and they're working on bids to do that. They've done a few things, and they're getting ready to put some of that out. Yeah, he said Chesty Puller talking about low intensity conflict. Talk about how the Marine Corps never does it right. You send 100 guys down there, and a month from now, 50 of them will be guarding something. So he said it's great stuff. But, yeah, it's about time, man. Honestly, it's about time. So that's pretty cool. You know what? A couple of notes. One, I'm glad that the White House stopped doing daily press conferences. Like, I don't know why the White did they do it to control messaging? Because I don't think it does that anymore. I think it just feeds this beast of 24/7. I think it makes it easy for 24/7 news cycles not to work hard to go get stories. I think it makes them lazy. They carry it live and then they comment about it, blah, 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 blah. You know? So, well, and maybe in that way it does set the tone for what's going to be discussed. I'm glad that they've stopped doing them for a while, so. We'll see how long that lasts. I have some thoughts on the president and birthright citizenship. So to me, before you have the discussion, I'll just say this before I get off today. Before you have the discussion, I think you have to look at when it was enacted, what situation, why it was adopted. Why would a new nation adopt that? And is it still appropriate? is it still appropriate? So I think once you gain a historical understanding of why it was initially adopted, are we still there? If we're still there, then, and it's important, then by all means. If we're not in that same place, if times have changed, is it still appropriate, or has it become a gateway to, for something else? So I think an enlightened discussion about that would be interesting. You know, and then I've heard people say, well, it's one of the things that make us different. Well, what is that? Get to the United States and have a kid? And then you can become a citizen too because your kid's a citizen? Is that how we want it done? Is that how we want it done? So anyway, I think it's an interesting discussion, but I don't think you start the discussion without an understanding of the history behind it. And I think too many people start the discussion completely ignorant of how that was adopted, why it was adopted, and its history. So get smart before you run your yap. Yeah, which would be a completely different thing in this country. So have a good day. On a Wednesday, All Marine Radio. Over and... well, not out yet. I'm serious. When I put this show up with the president, with the Secretary of Defense, share that link with your friends today. You want to get smart about world issues? Listen to this. Listen to this guy. It's only an hour. You can listen to it on your way home from work today. And he will paint for you pictures of where we are with Russia, where we are with China, where we are with Yemen, where we are in Iraq. Right? He will go around the tube. Where we are in, around the tube. That's right. Where we are relative to Saudi Arabia and the killing of the journalist, Mr. Khashoggi. So, all of that. And again, the biggest headline that's come out of it is Mattis sets a 30-day deadline for Yemen ceasefire. And this is the interview that comes out of. So, seriously, it's awesome, long format, in a little bit of detail, for smart people, right? Your stupid friends, they won't get it, so don't send it to them. But your smart people, your smart friends, send it to them, because they'll understand it. Now, with that said, on a Wednesday, thank you very much for listening, All Marine Radio. Happy Halloween to everybody. Over and out.